Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 325 of the Roguecast, recorded March 16th, 2021, The Schneider Cut.
It's podcast time.
Hell yeah. It's overcast outside, it's exciting. Nothing like a slightly overcast, vaguely muggy day.
A day in which we thought we might have late comics, so we're all especially extra groggy.
Yeah. I was ready. I was going to sleep in and have a non-comic pull morning, and then we had a comic pull morning.
Me too.
But,
I'm sorry I have to break that news for you lightly last night.
But it's good, because it means we had comics to read, and therefore we have a podcast. There was almost no podcast this week. In fact, in a different timeline, you're not listening to this podcast right now.
You, Russell Sinclair,
are not listening to this podcast right
the
now.
Our only listener.
And we have gone insane because we would have been doing inventory stuff, and that doesn't sound...
Instead, we have postponed our insanity.
Yes.
Just by, like, a few days.
Yes.
But still, it's something. And there's some fun comics this week to talk about.
Yeah,
it's a little bit of entertainment news. I don't remember if we're talking about any TV or movies and stuff.
Also, it is the week of Justice League, the Zack Snyder Cut.
Yeah.
That's true. Snyder Cut is coming.
I will say this. I will give it up for their marketing. You can't escape it. If you're in nerd circles, this is everywhere.
My wife didn't know what it was.
Really?
She's not in nerd circles.
I mean,
She's nerd adjacent.
Nick, that's a failure on your part.
I mean, I was like, do you want to watch the Snyder Cut? And she's like, what's the Snyder Cut? I'm like...
You didn't wake up every morning and be like... Four more days to the Snyder Cut, honey. You didn't start with that.
No, that's your failing, though. I guess it was my failing.
She thought it was the Schneider Cut of One Day at a Time.
She did know about Captain America and our Falcon and Winter Soldier on Friday, so I guess I've done something right.
For the record, I would rather watch the Schneider Cut of Justice League.
The Photoshop in Schneider from One Day at a Time.
It's not also Invincible Week, right? Is that one
no,
more week?
No, that's one more week out.
Okay, yes. I thought there was going to be like three things, and I'm like, oh, that's a lot of comic in one week.
Yeah,
There's some of those things you could skip.
As always, on these things, the three fates of Rogues Gallery.
Yes.
There's the love, hate, and then in the middle thing.
Right. Someone must be the fate centrist.
And in this, I believe, Nick, you're the one who's going to watch it.
Yeah, we're talking about Snyder here.
We're talking about the Snyder Cut. And I don't believe, by the way, I don't know if you're like super excited for it, but you're going to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, I have a passing liking of the Joss Whedon version. Yep. Zack Snyder has made at least some passable movies, mostly bad ones.
Listen, we all kind of liked Watchmen. We all kind of liked 300.
Hey,
at least
I have sat through the director's cut of Batman vs Superman multiple times because I actually enjoy it.
That's on you, Nick.
On some level.
Did we like 300? I remember standing outside a theater talking with Dan about how dumb it was.
I think I was the odd man out as the most hatery of it. But I think we all kind of were a little bit like, that was cool action.
Yeah.
It was neat when they played the cool music and the people got stabbed.
Yeah. Amongst my friends, everyone was all gung-ho for the cool slow-motion action sequences, and I was the only one sitting back and be like, this is stupid.
I actually do, like, here's the thing, I loved Frank Miller's graphic novel of it. I thought it was just a really potent, you know, piece of graphic novel storytelling.
Yep.
It is one of those, like, yeah, kind of looking back on it, there's, like, a lot of veiled xenophobia, or barely veiled. But it didn't, like, it actually was less so than, like, the movie where, like, there's, like, the Persians seem to have, like, orcs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The same way that I've seen this in, like, some of Mel Gibson movies, like Apocalypto and stuff like that, too. Like, they like, kind of remap them as, like, androgynous at times, and that's also supposed to be other and evil. And I'm like, there's some gross stuff in there. Some really gross stuff in there.
Also elephants.
And elephants, randomly. Elephants, they forgot that they thought they were Hannibal.
I think a lot of my excitement boils down to the fact that I love these characters, regardless. These DC characters have made an impact on my life over the years.
Dave, you are the centrist in this one?
I think so. I would say I liked Whedon's... I actually liked Whedon's one all right. I had a pretty good time when I saw it. Mm-hmm. And he sort of... I was a little weirded out that it does seem to be a standard, you know, an accepted truth that it was awful. And I'm like, oh, I thought it was, like, okay. And I think that's kind of what people mostly thought at the time. They thought it was all right, even if it underperformed a bit. But that said, I'm not planning to watch this.
And I, of course, have not seen a DC movie since Man of Steel, and I hate Zack Snyder, and I want this to be terrible.
That's not true. Is that right? Wonder Woman and you saw Wonder Woman 84.
Those aren't Zack Snyder movies.
Those are DC movies.
Oh, okay. I thought Zack Snyder had a separate brand.
He did produce all of those movies, his own genre. Okay. Yes,
that's what I mean. I didn't see Batman v Superman. I didn't see Justice League. Is that the only two? There's just some of those two.
Are you talking about Snyder's?
I haven't seen Aquaman either.
Yeah.
But that was James Wan.
You're looking at Aquaman. we were talking about this off mic earlier. In the year of like pandemic and having survived 4 years of He Who Will Not Be Named, if people want to enjoy this, I am for it. I will stand back and let people enjoy it. I have kind of zero interest in it because, like, here's the thing. If there were – part of the reason I sometimes will like that is because I do like seeing different DC characters reinterpreted. It's something they do in the comics all the time. So I'm not, like – I wasn't, like, so offended by, like, his Ayn Randian Pa Kent is not really Pa Kent vision and all that stuff. Yeah. But – because it was like, oh, it's just one more version among a billion of them. But there's a great Superman show out right now. Mm-hmm. I'm getting my fill of Superman. I don't kind of like feel the need to just kind of watch something because it's there. I will just watch the regular Superman and Lois show.
And I agree with you to some extent that people should not yuck anyone's yums, and I try not to be that guy. On this particular one, I'm making an exception because it makes me mad that basically while we get Zack Snyder's DC-verse, we don't get actual DC comics. And I love those characters too, and I would like them in a version I will enjoy. So I hate its existence on that basis.
And so that is what the fates
have decreed.
Decreed, yeah.
With 109 reviews, though, it's still at 76%. Which is so weird.
I believe it's all Zack Snyder Bros. They're holding these reviewers dogs hostage.
I mean, it's possible. I'm not gonna.
Nick, just out of curiosity, what is Watchmen at?
That's got to be
one of his more competent movies. I bet it's in the 60s or 70s.
David just pictured like the front of a DVD cover, and it's like competent.
One of his more competent outings. Yes.
The Rolling Stone calls it almost a good movie.
65.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. That sounds about right.
And that's after some time to settle down.
Yeah.
I bet like the early weeks of it, there was a bit more enthusiasm, and I bet it was in the 70s. Yeah. So I think this is kind of going to be like one of those sorts of things where like afterwards people will be like, oh, yeah, I think I got caught up in the hype a little bit on that one. Or like there was some neat scenes in it. Like the action, I did like when it was slow-mo and Leonidas kicked that guy into the pit.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird when Superman lasered that guy's head off.
This is Apocalypse.
So the big star news this week is that we got the new D&D book, Candlekeep Mysteries.
Yeah.
We got really allocated on the special covers, so those are gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, we're sorry. We like to have those available for people. We would absolutely have more of them if we could. But as it is, we got to go with the regular cover because they just didn't give us enough.
Yeah, we got about a little over half what we ordered. So, yeah.
We were trying. Randy, can you quick tell me, what is Candlekeep Mysteries?
Yeah, so Candlekeep is this cool place in Forgotten Realms that is basically a big library/fortress.
Mm-hmm.
It is like there's like archmages that run the place. I was reading through the opening part, which goes into the Candlekeep before they get the adventure stuff. The book has like 17 mini adventures, but it's also a source book on Candlekeep, which is basically the repository of all knowledge. Like if you need some kind of deep mystical knowledge, you can go there. And they've got all the rules in the library, which is like you can't take books out, you can't mark or modify them. And
if you want to have like an adventure that has some kind of cool bit of lore or intrigue or people trying to get to some rare document or something like that, this would be like a great staging ground or a springboard for lots of adventure.
They also talk about there's no fighting, you can't teleport in, you can't fly over, like they've got all these crazy magical wards and stuff. So it's a cool little place. And the book itself has that, says all the stuff, the source book stuff at the beginning, and then has like 17 mini adventures.
That's really cool.
It's a good little book. Alright, news. This is the Free Comic Book Day. We're still debating how we're going to pull this off. Free Comic Book Day is on the schedule this year. I think that's a mistake.
For May, whatever? For
August.
Oh, okay.
So they said to August 14th, which is basically the last possible Saturday before everybody goes back to school.
Okay. That's a ways enough out that there could be...
We don't know where we're going to...
Vaccination penetration at that point, like, of a decent amount.
Yeah, so we'll be doing something. We don't know whether it'll be a full day or whether we'll do some kind of like drive-by kind of thing. I don't know.
Right.
But Boom just announced their free comic book day offering.
Yep.
And it's another great title. From the people who brought you Something is Killing the Children,
yep.
It's called House of Slaughter. And it is a spinoff from Something is Killing the Children.
Oh.
Because the House of Slaughter is where Erica Slaughter, the lead.
That's right.
It's like, this is like their Watcher Council, basically. They're the people
they all
who
wear those fun masks.
They train the monster hunter types. So this is going to go into that story.
Cool. It is he's creating a shared Something is Killing the Children verse.
Yeah. Something is killing the children verse.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Something's killing the children verse? Well, no, it's a universe of something. Nothing is killing the children verse. It hasn't even started yet.
Could somebody turn that into an acronym so I can add, like the MCU, I need the... Something is killing the children universe.
If you Yoda it up,
yeah.
It becomes sick.
The sick you. Wow. All right. Well, we'll get the marketing team on it.
Yeah.
And
we'll see
what we can cook up.
The CW reboot has cast its Powerpuff Girls. They're doing
an adult. Like teens, or so like 20-somethings?
Yeah, they're 20-somethings. It is basically a live-action. The notion is that the Powerpuff Girls are disillusioned 20-somethings who resent having lost their childhoods to crime-fighting. So
it's a bunch of pretty girls, and it seems weird to me because they're such kiddie characters.
So one of the girls is Chloe Bennett, who is the lead of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Okay.
Dove Cameron from Descendants was a Disney property. And Yana Peralt from Jagged Little Pill. I don't even know what that is.
Was Dove Cameron... She wasn't, like, the person who played, like, Dagger in Cloak and Dagger, was she?
It's possible. I don't know. Doesn't say.
I don't need my Powerpuff Girls to be angsty CW characters.
So I need sexy Powerpuff Girls now.
It's co-written by Diablo Cody.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting. That's Juno's writer. And what was the one, the movie, the horror thing?
Oh, Jennifer's Body.
Jennifer's Body. I am not a personal fan, but I remember I've seen at least some other. What was that show she did for like Showtime or HBO or whatever? The someone who had multiple personality.
Yeah, United States of Terror.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And like I saw bits and pieces of that, and there was some stuff I liked in there. So I'm like, she is a clever and interesting writer.
Yeah, she's a good writer.
I'll allow it. That gives me a little bit more interest. Or actually, I have zero interest, but
that sounds a little bit of craft.
It sounds a little less just straight tawdry.
I don't know why you guys would think that. CW has a...
Didn't they do Riverdale?
Yeah, but CW also didn't they do Riverdale? Like a thousand...
Isn't Riverdale super tawdry?
It is, but it's super fun.
But they also did like a thousand like Vampire Diary-esque...
I think all those are competent.
They like, are.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I have no interest. I'm well outside the target demo, but they're all...
There's something about taking characters that were like supposed to be like six-year-olds, I guess, and like making a... Like, if it was just like some invented characters that were just some like kids who were like teen crime fighters or something, that'd be one thing. It's the Powerpuff Girls specifically, although it like always have this wit and stuff to that was like kind of an adult wit.
Yeah.
It seems weird to me to do the...
I legit loved the Powerpuff Girls. I thought it was a really fun cartoon.
Dave, you're going to hate my Full House spinoff in which the youngest girl is now hunting serial killers in San Francisco.
I mean, are they going to have a weird live-action Mojo Jojo?
Someone did post a picture of like... how are they going to do this in live action where Mojo Jojo gets the crap kicked out of him? So, I don't know. That would be great if Mojo Jojo, if they do a CGI Mojo Jojo that's... I'm for it. I think this will be kind of fun. We'll see.
I think I'll have to... I was going to say see a trailer, but like the thing is, like I was only ever the most casual Powerpuff Girls fans. It seemed pretty good from what I saw, just not necessarily my thing. There was no point where I was going to watch this anyway.
Speaking of CW, we saw the trailer for Kung Fu, the sort of new revamp of the
old David Carradine, thing.
It's completely different. It's set in San Francisco, it looks like.
Yeah.
It is a young girl who is, like, doing the crime-fighting thing.
And she was, going to law school,
going to law school, and she tells her family she's not going to do it, and they're like, yes, you are. But instead, she's going to become a vigilante crime fighter.
Yep. It looks like pretty high energy, slightly Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon
the
style
fights
of Kung Fu.
Great, like the action looks fantastic.
Yeah, it looks like really well choreographed and kind of fun. I kind of liked its vibe.
I think if only because I've been watching CBS procedural stuff this week.
Yeah,
I'm in the mood of like, oh, I might watch this.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I'll check it out.
I don't think any of us thinks it's like, oh, that looks great.
No.
But it looks like fun.
Looks like fun. Also, they posted a picture of the Eclipso they're going to do for Stargirl Season 2.
Right, supernatural bad guy Eclipso from DC.
Cool.
Yeah. He's creepy looking.
Yeah.
Does he have the gem?
I think he does. He's also got like the felt cap. He looks a little bit like the Bart Sears interpretation.
The one from the Eclipso miniseries in the 90s where they kind of did like a more of a less of a superhero look and more of like a kind of almost fantasy look. He looks like this weird wizard mummy creepy guy.
Yeah, he does look a little lumpy and undead.
Yeah.
Yeah, that looks solid.
Yeah, I liked it.
He's got the gem and like a pendant on his neck.
Okay, all right.
Eclipso is one of those weird bad guys I've always kind of liked. Same. I remember reading some in the Art of Walt Simonson that DC produced in like late 80s or early 90s that just kind of collected his odds and ends DC work from the late 70s or maybe early 80s, that Eclipso was in some stories with Dr. Fate, I think, maybe?
Oh, that makes sense. I think, wasn't he, like, one of his nemesis or something?
Yeah. Simonson was drawing him in the kind of classic superhero style, but you know how he, like, in the same way that he made, like, his Asgardians, like, them look less like space gods and a little more Viking?
Yeah.
He kind of, I think, was maybe, like, starting to get a little bit more into that slightly fantasy look for him, and I've always liked him. He's a weird villain. He's got cool, weird powers. A good name.
Yep.
Ridiculous Silver Age name.
Well, and he's like a Hulk type because he's like this. There's this archaeologist who he's like bonded to.
That's
like,
right.
But they did a really interesting revamp in the because he was just like a bad guy.
Yeah.
He had like a dark blast and all this kind of stuff. But they did a revamp of him in like the 90s in this crossover event where he was like revealed to be like a dark god.
And I forgot about that.
He was the Spectre's opposite number. He was like the previous God of Judgment.
Yeah, they kind of elevated him to a much higher level.
And the little dark gems that he used were like people would find them and become possessed by him and that kind of stuff.
It sounds like they were in their own way shooting for a little bit of an Infinity Gems thing. But that kind of expanding of the mythology, I think, is often a good idea.
It was really good. And they did a series that when Suicide Squad was not being published, they did a Suicide Squad goes down to like this South American country that Eclipso was running and had to like try to take out his host. So it was a fun series.
As an aside, the greatest gimmick cover of the 90s of them all. Eclipso does have like a gem usually in his forehead.
He holds up this like gem and focuses his powers through it.
Yeah.
Right. And so the comic actually had like an embedded cheap little violet plastic gem on the cover, meaning that whatever when you stacked them, the comic it dented whatever comic was above it. But it's battle scarring. Anyway, it was ridiculous, but kind of fun.
But David, it's not the best cover of the 90s.
What was the best cover of the
90s? The best cover of the 90s was from Malibu Comics. It was a little superhero book called The Protectors.
Okay.
I think it was issue number 4. One of their characters has been shot, and they actually took the covers, which show the bloody chest of the hero, and they fired a gun through it.
Oh,
so there
right.
was a literal bullet hole in every issue of Protectors number 4.
I do remember this, yes.
I assume the intern who was holding them up is dead.
the trashiest gimmick cover I remember, and one of the earliest ones, this would have been very early 90s, was when they launched Legends of the Dark Knight, an otherwise very good Batman comic that's spinning out of sort of Batman Year One type of stories. But the covers were just, they had these like solid color.
They had four different solid colors.
Four solid colors. Like this one was magenta, this one was, you know, yellow.
It was the same cover underneath. It was just a overlap thing.
Yeah, it was like a little cover over a cover. We're all used to variant covers. These ones, they were just literally a flat, solid color.
Was that the first time they were trying this? That what started all of this?
I remember that, and then like the Titans was relaunching at the time, and they did that awful gimmick where the little two-page backup story
were all different
in like five different variants of the first issue.
Yes, that was terrible.
And like this was like the earliest, greediest versions of it.
And also, I felt for all of that, by the way.
Yeah,
I had all five of the Teen Titans variants.
Yeah.
I had five different covers of X-Force so I could get all the trading cards.
Uh-huh.
And I had all four covers Legends of the Dark Knight.
Man, I forgot how quickly they went all in and did that stuff. Incidentally, like, at least some of those were tied to good comics. Like, Legends of the Dark Knight really was a very good comic.
Mm-hmm. It was.
Are you saying that X-Force number 1 wasn't a good comic?
It was not a good comic.
You may notice I didn't mention it.
I still have a lot of fondness for it, regardless of its aging.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, everybody can like things. It's good to like things.
Yeah. Don't want a yucca yum.
In other news, Doom Patrol has cast its Madame Rouge.
Yes, a very obscure villain that probably not that many people
really
know.
Not that obscure, right? Isn't she a member of, like, the Evil Brother? The
Brotherhood of Evil of there? But yeah, but, like, they haven't done too much with her. I think you got to be a somewhat, like, a casual DC fan might still not have ever heard of her. But people who've been around the block, they know about her. No. People who know who've been reading DC since the 80s or 70s or 60s, they know the deal.
But they cast Michelle Gomez, who has this great evil face.
That's amazing.
Who is she?
She's in Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
She plays Madame Satan.
Okay.
And she was also in the Flight Attendant.
Flight Attendant, yeah.
And she was great in that.
So you think she's going to bring something cool to this?
Fantastic casting, yeah. She's great.
They generally seem to have done pretty good casting with Doom Patrol.
Also, Madame Rouge is, like our name, Rouge's Gallery.
Madame Rogue.
There is in news that that made our staffer Anna Squee, or something similar to it.
Yeah.
They announced a Crush and Lobo miniseries.
For people who don't know, Crush is the daughter of Lobo, who was introduced in the new Teen Titans series that was by Adam Glass of Supernatural fame. Yep. It was a very good run. Is she queer, bisexual?
She really has broken up with her girlfriend, left the Teen Titans, and goes to break her dad out of space jail.
Okay, so
I thought they hated each other. I thought Lobo tried to kill her.
And like attacked her and like beat up all the Teen Titans in the path of doing it.
That's just Lobo. That's what he does.
I think, like, yeah, you know, the world of supers is so heightened at some point. I don't know if I can say that I think of him as an abusive dad, as I think of him as just a lout.
Yeah.
You know, he's just like a comic book lout. I do kind of like the idea of this, you know, doing a father-daughter story with the biggest asshole dad of them all.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that done right, it could be quite good. You know, brokenhearted relationship stuff could be good as well. Crush is a fun character. She's got a cool design.
Yep.
I think that sounds fun.
Octavia Butler, who's a sort of a well-known sci-fi writer.
Yeah.
She has a novel and a graphic novel, actually. They did a graphic novel with this, called Kindred. Which is basically a young writer finds himself pulled back and forward in time to a plantation and then the future. And this is being developed for FX TV now.
Interesting. Say the premise again.
So she is a young black aspiring writer, finds herself being pulled back and forth in time from her life in modern day Los Angeles all the way back to a plantation in the 19th century.
Okay.
So this kind of sounds like that movie Antebellum, except not.
I know that, like, Antebellum was kind of criticized, and I had several friends who said this is kind of like that misery porn.
Yeah.
I know that as far as, like, these kind of horror and, like, African-American character stories that we've seen a little bit more of, that one of the things I noticed about Lovecraft Country, another example, was that every episode, while there were bad things that were the people were dealing with all the time and tragedies, there was also a lot of black joy in them.
Yep.
They would show parties, get-togethers, casual hanging out at, like, diners, just friendships. Yep. And it was like every episode seemed to, like, showcase that in some way. But it did make me kind of keenly aware that, yes, there was a lot of stories. Sometimes, you know, sometimes a hand-wringing liberal has written this, and they do just kind of want to just, like, wallow in the misery.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know where she's going to land on that spectrum.
Yeah.
It's not as... And also, by the way, I'm, like, I'm a person who really likes, I don't know, Grapes of Wrath and stuff like that. Like, and some things that are, you know, pretty misery porny. So I'm not, like, I'm not against dark stories about dark times. But, any vibe on this?
No idea.
How's it being developed?
It's being developed for FX.
FX, okay, so it's going to be a show.
Yeah.
I feel like it'll probably be...
A show has some opportunity for some nuance that a movie might not, and I kind of like that.
And FX is usually pretty good about their shows.
They're pretty solid, yeah.
Boy, am I just glad that they didn't end up doing that story from the Game of Thrones people.
The Confederacy?
Yeah, the one where the Confederates the won, and it was going to be, like, slavery was still around in the present.
I'm talking about not the moment.
Man, yeah. I know that they weren't going to be like, this is great, but Jesus, don't do that during fucking Trump's administration.
There's also the big news, of course, is that we got a teaser that the Star Trek Strange New Worlds has begun production.
Yeah, that's the Pike show, if you will.
Yep.
Anybody's watched Discovery. Sometimes even I would say people who weren't the biggest fans of Discovery were like, oh man, this guy nails it as Pike.
Yep.
He kind of has a little bit of old school swagger in kind of that likable way, but like, you know, like Kirk, but without the sort of the baggage that comes with Shatner. Mm-hmm. And so he was like a really likable captain when he showed up in it. And, you know, that's why there was so much fandom saying, hey, give this guy a show. Well, mm-hmm. he's getting a show and now they're filming it.
Yeah. They announced the cast who... I don't recognize any of these names.
Well, there's the rest of the cast, because we know the supporting the core three are going to be Pike, Spock, mm-hmm. and number one.
Is Rebecca Romijn coming back?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. good.
And what's the guy's name who plays Spock?
I don't remember, something. I forget his name, but yeah.
Ethan Peck.
Maybe.
Is that right?
I don't know.
Anyway, I think that's who it is.
You're our Star Trek expert.
I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know facty facts.
You run a podcast.
We have a Star Trek podcast.
But anyway, so these are going to be supporting characters who you might, in a pinch, think of as like the Chekhov, Sulu, Uhura, maybe more developed than those characters were in the day. But, Randy, any notes on them?
As I look, I'm like, there's a couple of people from Black Mirror. There's another person from Jagged Little Pill, which is the second time that's come up today, which apparently is a Broadway musical based on Alanis Morissette's music.
Crazy. Huh. Yeah, but I kind of think that's a good idea.
And then somebody who was in Billions in some role. Here's the thing that's interesting. So I guess Babs Olesen Mokins was in The Defenders, Marvel's The Defenders.
Okay.
She was also in The Night Of, he was in The Night Of. So I've seen him, I just don't recognize him.
Okay.
So,
I mean, I assume that, like, Discovery, we're continuing a trend of diversity mm-hmm. to show that the future isn't the sea of white faces that Trek used to be. Even with Trek's diversity out of the gate, it was still a pretty white series for the longest time.
So what's interesting is, as I look at this, they have quotes from the two showrunners. One of them is Henry Alonzo Myers. I don't know who that is. But the other co-showrunner is Akiva Goldsman,
yep.
who is famously... like, written some really terrible movies. He was, like, involved with both the Batman movie, the Joel Schumacher Batman movies. But as involved in Star Trek, somehow he has been really good.
Well, you know, I posted that video the other day, which sounds insane, but it's like the lost masterpiece that is Batman Forever. But this is a guy whose film channel, like, actually does some kind of very fun, in-depth videos. And, Randy, do you know about the supposed Schumacher cut?
Oh, God.
yeah. This is a thing that was discussed. I don't believe it actually exists, but then again, nobody thought the Snyder Cut existed, and they still found it.
Well, that's because they made it.
There was a script with a more nuanced take on Batman in Batman Forever, and I actually highly recommend this video. It's entertaining to watch, if nothing else.
Yeah, you sent it to me last night, and I still didn't click on it. I need
you
to.
You should watch it. I believe you will enjoy it, Nick. But it does point out the handful of scenes that exist, and there is some, I think, awareness of like what some of the other scenes would have filled in. But there's actually the through line thematics were pretty good for Batman Forever, as crazy as that sounds. I believe it became its own kind of wild camp production, you know, like that took over and like anything, and you know, nuance went out the window.
Right.
But I think it existed.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, Akiva Goldsman does seem to have found a place. Now, I still sometimes Discovery will do things that irk me.
Yeah,
and sure. Their finales have particularly kind of left me a little bit I don't know, annoyed, weary, something, dissatisfied. But it's a role that's worked for him.
Yeah,
maybe everybody's got something in them. Everybody getting something.
Everybody getting something. All right, that's it for news for us of the week. We're going to talk about comics when we come back. We are talking for comics the week of March 17th, and...
Should we start with DC?
Yeah, so DC only has four books this week. But they're all the War Relaunch kind of books. So
and it's continues to be pretty interesting.
Yeah. So I guess the first thing to note is that there is a Catwoman book by Ram V, or Ram V, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know how you say it, but it's spelled what? Like Ram? Like R-A-M?
He's their new up-and-comer. He wrote the Swamp Thing book that people seem to have dug.
Yep. They seem to have, like, I walked in on this, I thought the art looked really good, and I was just wanting to check it out, and I thought it was a really solid first issue, or new direction issue, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But she has her own staked out place, and I'm going to forget what it is, like Alley Town, I think they call it.
Okay.
You know, the same way that there's, like, Burnside, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's the Narrows, and just, like, over time, new areas of Gotham get staked out. Well, Alleytown seems like it's the place that's Catwoman's territory, and she's running up against some new foes in this. She's forming an unlikely alliance with the Riddler, who I think is, like, in a weird space because he had to... There was, like, some drug he was on. I don't know what it was. It's Batman
Riddling.
Comics.
Riddlin'.
Oh, that's messed up. Poison ivy. There's like this organization that seems to be like growing different poison ivies, like to use as their own. They basically all they want is the plant control or like the
weird
stuff. Yeah. But
is Catwoman good or bad or always as always in between?
She's in between.
Isn't she married to Batman still, or that get did they?
It's sure not mentioned in this.
Did they get bat divorced?
No, I think they're together. I think it's just that like. They don't live together.
She's got her own career.
Yeah, she's got her own career. Well, they don't have to stay at the same place.
Yeah. Batman lost all his money, and she's like, "I'm out."
She was when someone came to her, like, "Oh, there's like a detective or whatever who was like a quasi love interest, I think, in the previous run, and he shows up in this, and he goes to like her apartment, and there's like another blonde woman like lying like on a bed there, and I don't know if it's like a girlfriend of hers or if that was just like Holly. You remember,
yeah,
you know, Holly, who they've done
sure.
stuff
yeah.
with and with Brubaker's run and all that stuff over the years. It wasn't like particularly intimated they were lovers in it. But anyway, I thought it was a good first issue. And really excellent art, and there was a kind of a weird, creepy new villain in it too.
There's also a new anthology series called Superman Red and Blue, which is all done in like red and blue colors.
Yeah, but like with different styles on it, so that it doesn't quite. The art is not as samey as you might think it would look from that. Steve Lieber is one of the artists on it, and I thought his stuff looked really good. But basically, Superman fans have another book to check out.
Yep. And then Justice League number 59, which is a new Justice League with Brian Bendis writing. And you can see from the cover, it's the interesting thing, they're going to bring in, like, Black Adam.
Right.
And
many of them are kind of classic League members. Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are in there.
Yep.
I believe.
Although it's not Wonder Woman. I believe Yara Flor is the Wonder Woman we're going to
get. Oh, okay. Well, she is a Wonder Woman, I guess, just not classic Wonder Woman.
So the main ones that show up are Superman, Aquaman, Batman, and Hawkgirl.
Yep. And then the new character is going to be Black Adam, Naomi, from his own miniseries he co-wrote with, who was that writer?
David Walker. And it's either Yara Flor or Hippolyta is going to be the Wonder Woman.
Oh, I've heard Hippolyta's in it. I know it's her.
And then it looks like from the cover that Green Arrow and Black Canary are also on the team.
Yep.
Anyway, they're fighting a new villain, and that's all there is to say about that. There's also a Justice League Dark backup in it. And then the big DC for the week, Tom Taylor is taking over along with his Suicide Squad, and I think Injustice 2 artist Bruno Redondo, Nightwing with number 78, which the fates of Rogue Gallery are divided on a little bit, although we all liked it.
I think this all falls into a like category.
We all liked it, although Dave liked it the least.
Right.
I liked it quite a bit, and Nick loved it.
I did. I loved it.
This is a... you know, this isn't like a complete reinvention of Nightwing. This has this takes the character in a somewhat positive direction, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Also returns him to Bloodhaven, and so people who liked the Chuck Dixon run in the 90s, I think, will enjoy revisiting that place with Blockbuster as the crime boss who runs it and like has like a stranglehold on, you know, political leaders and stuff like that in there. Tom Taylor always strikes this kind of good balance between sort of, I'm going to say, optimism, adventure, some heartfelt stuff in it. I don't want to say maybe quite
and
whatever.
Some bloody violence.
And some bloody violence.
Yep.
I've always liked Blockbuster. He's a fun villain.
Yeah,
and he is like the kingpin of
right.
The
I was saying to Randy, this guy got one of the ultimate glow ups because he used to be just like he literally was just a bruiser.
Yeah,
he was kind of like a low level Hulk thug bad guy.
Yeah,
and then something happened that like enlarged his brain, cranium, whatever. He became super smart. Started wearing suits. Next thing you know, this guy runs Bloodhaven, and yeah, kingpin comparison is completely apt.
Yep.
Also,
Nightwing gets a dog.
He gets a dog.
There's some great stuff between him and Barbara, and there's a big sort of status quo change at the end.
Yep, and he's sort of touching letter.
This may be some of my favorite art by Bruno Redondo. There's a 2-page spread of Nightwing just kind of jumping across the rooftops that is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it's amazing.
This felt like
a mission statement too, because like that, like he's like it's like a, I don't know, like a dawn, I think, right there.
Yeah.
And I think he very much wanted to, portray this as the Nightwing, who is a fairly positive hero. Not that he's got everything together, but he's not Bruce.
The shot in the head, Rick, Dan DiDio trying to get rid of Nightwing constantly thing, era is over.
That lasted for way too long.
Well, Dan DiDio tried to kill him several times.
Yeah.
Like, he really wanted to kill Nightwing off.
It's the stupidest thing.
Yeah.
This is a character that's beloved, who only had room to grow.
Yep.
And, yeah, he wanted to throw that away.
Yep.
They killed him, in quotation marks, made him a spy.
Yep.
Then they
Which was fun. I think it was fun.
It was fun. And then he came back, then got shot in the head, and became Rick for a year and a half.
Yep.
Man.
And it was just like, this was so refreshing.
No wonder it felt like a breath of fresh air to you.
Yeah, it was refreshing that he wasn't the heel of the DC Universe. He was actually getting to be the hero that he is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good first issue. And Tom Taylor is just really, probably still the best writer of DC.
Yes, this makes me want Tom Taylor to just basically, like you've said many a times, just write
just
DC
give, Just give the DC Universe to Tom Taylor. Let him assign writers if he can't do everything. But I
want him in charge.
That remains my position. Sorry, did you just...
No, I was just sort of vaguely musing. Like, I was trying to think of like who else could be in a stable. You know, somebody who I do think... I haven't loved his mainstream stuff, but I still think that there's good stuff in it, is Jeff Lemire.
Yeah.
And I feel like he could potentially, like if he was, like, handling the Justice League dark sort of circles of the DC Universe. We might have to put this together at some point. Like, if we were, like, rebuilding it, what writers we would, like, ideally want in there. Let's work on that later.
Image has a couple interesting books this week. One is Ultra Mega Number One, which is...
it is Ultra Mega sized.
Writer artist James Herron doing a... Yeah, it's like 70-some pages. Nick, you read this.
Yeah, no. So in my brain, I got confused to James Herron one. I was thinking he was Daniel Warren Johnson for some weird reason. And I was like, oh. And then in the backup, it says this is his first time writing as a writer. And I was like, oh, that doesn't make sense. But I actually really enjoyed this.
This
sort
is
of,
very violent. I'm flipping
it
through it right now.
It's extremely violent.
But it's like a kind of Ultraman, Godzilla, kaiju kind of thing, right? But with like...
It's Sentai versus... Kaiju.
Is that what they
show?
Yeah, like Super Sentai.
Yeah. And
but it looks like it has like Invincible's violence level.
Yeah, he says he doesn't know a ton about those genres, but he wants to sort of play off of that and a couple of other sort of more kind of violent things and kind of stretches writing legs. And artistically, it's really
sometimes
cool.
I kind of like when people who aren't like but like 100% familiar with the genre or related genres does something and they like they don't know what the rules are and what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do, and like it's kind of interesting.
The danger is when you get someone who thinks they're doing something new but they're doing the same thing everybody has already done.
Right.
Here's, but that doesn't seem to be happening.
A good example, I think, is Batman 89.
Yeah.
It doesn't particularly get Batman, you know, from the comics.
Right.
But it is interesting. It's super fun.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about this one, and it's not giving away because it's on the first page, is that there's a new virus that's introduced to the world. And
that's
it's like
not
a
cool, Nick.
It's a kaiju virus that sort of
that is
like
cool.
Turns people into sort of monstrous beings.
Ooh, yeah.
And then there are three people who, an alien race sort of a la the Guardians of the Universe, select to be their heroes.
Okay.
And it's not a glamorous job at all, because the virus only like activates in people when these guys are around them.
Yeah.
Huh.
So it's kind of just like they're always on duty, so
yeah.
It's just I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was a fun take on the genre, and I feel like his artwork is just gorgeous.
It is cool, really artwork. Pretty
looking I love his monster designs.
Did we say that Dave Stewart is doing coloring on it? Yeah, I mean, Dave Stewart's Dave one Stewart's. Of the best colorists.
And they worked together on BPRD.
They did, yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
Also, Image has Invincible Number 1, the Amazon Prime Edition, which basically is just a reprinting of Invincible Number 1. But if you wanted to get a look at it before the animated series hits, I read it. I forgot what a good first issue this is.
It is a good first issue.
Did that, when did that debut? 15 years ago-ish or something?
At least. It might be longer. Do you remember that it was part of a superhero universe?
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember.
Fire Breather from Phil Hester. And a couple other books that are completely...
Yeah, it was sort of a loose alliance of...
Because they showed up every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. But there's like a little 4-page backup that like is a little teaser for the animated series. But yeah, it's kind of a little fun Invincible redo. Also, Dark Horse has Orphan and the Five Beasts, a new crazy martial arts fantasy book by James Stocco, who has this... stunning art style. He's done a bunch of Godzilla stuff.
That Alien Dead Orbit.
Did you, Randy, you ever see Ninja Scroll?
Yeah.
That anime?
Yeah.
That kind of hyper-violent anime? Yeah. It has a little something in common with that, as filtered through James Stocco's own almost kind of surreal sensibilities. But that sort of, you know, high level of violence. And,
turned up to
11. But a little absurd, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got the art is, I mean, art alone is worth a read. It's stunning.
Yep.
He's got this crazy frenetic anime energy. But, yeah, his crazy premise, basically, the orphan is like someone trained in all these martial arts, and he has to go fight these five beasts who are masters of the dark arts as well. And this is his first fight, and it's super cool. The Bequest is an Aftershock book by Tim Seeley, and is basically, the premise, I think, is the D&D world comes to our world, essentially.
Well, it's almost more like there's an illegal trade of goods going on between a D&D world and, like, modern-day Chicago, I think.
Yeah.
Where they're, like... I forget exactly how it works, but I believe, you know, like, weapons and gear and stuff like that from the present and technology that are sent back to, like, D&D time, D&D world. And they're, like... There's, like, a dragon whose, like, energy they're sapping. And, And then, meanwhile, like... there's like a hit pulled early on where they like put away all their assault rifles and stuff and use a wand instead to try and like run a hit in gangland style. Anyway, kind of a neat premise. And Tim's working with the artist that was the guy who did the Batman like Ninja Turtles stuff, I think.
Yeah, Freddie Williams. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a one-shot King in Black this week, King in Black Amazing Spider-Man, which is notable that it's written by Jed McKay, who's one of my favorite new writers. And it basically teams him up with the obscure Avengers Academy character, Reptil.
Yeah.
A teenager can turn into dinosaurs. And it's a good, solid one-issue story. Like, you don't even have to be reading King in Black. It's just a good Spider-Man story about what Spider-Man and these lower-level heroes do in the midst of these crazy cosmic things. Like, what is their job?
I kind of like those stories.
Yeah, it's a really fun one-shot.
I do remember a classic scene, by the way, when... from Burns' FF run, where I think people were, like, fighting Galactus in the city... And you see, like, Daredevil and, like, Spider-Man are just sitting on a rooftop, and they're just like, it's beyond us. They're just like, we cannot do anything.
This is kind of funny, though. Basically, Spidey happens upon Reptil has rescued this older lady and is, like, flying her away. And at first he mistakes her for a villain, so he, like, comes in and punches him. And then he's like, oh, I'm sorry. But the woman is, like, having none of it. She's got this, like, stone face. And she's basically, like, giving him the cold shoulder. And as they're flying away, Spidey's like, he's like, so, Mrs. Volkov, where are we taking you? And she just kind of stares at him.
Mm-hmm.
And Reptil's like, she's a big Daily Bugle fan from way back, I think. Which I thought was just kind of great.
Yeah, I believe that.
Can Jen McKay supplant Nick Spencer on Spider-Man?
I would love for McKay to be the guy writing Spider-Man.
He feels like he has a love for that world, because Black Cat is so good, and this is apparently so good. I just feel like he would be really good on that.
Captain America 80th Anniversary issue, which is kind of like the giant-size X-Men they did, and I think they're going to do more of these, where it's basically they take the script from Captain America Comics number 1, and then Avengers number 4, and they have different big-name artists do one page each.
Like, I forgot it was another one of those. I need to flip through that and check it out.
And it's got, like, John Castay. It's got Peach Momoko. I'm trying to look at some of the other names. Neil Francis Yu, Jesus Sayas, Adam Kubert, Jim Chung, Steve Epting, Chris Samney. There's a bunch of different people. Everybody does a page. It's super fun. It's a neat experiment. There is a new series, Trials of Ultraman, which follows up on the Rise of Ultraman series from Marvel. And then there's the TMNT Last Ronin Director's Cut came out this week.
Yeah, this is, you know, in the long gaps between new issues, it looks like they're going to throw out some, like, Director's Cut type stuff. I will say this. I flipped through this. They did a really good job with it. Aside from, of course, including all the actual first issue is in it. Mm-hmm. There's an afterword that kind of explains how this project came together. There's what I believe must be a actual, like, printout from, like, the 1980s, as it is on a dot matrix printer.
Wow.
And you can see every dot in it that looks like it's the original pitch. You know, I'd heard that this came from a story that Eastman and Laird were thinking of back then, and it looks like this is the notes and, like, with lots of circles and keep this, get rid of this kind of stuff in it. There's tons of breakdowns from the pair of them that was, like, showed the actual, like, they didn't draw the issue, but it looks like I don't know if it's one or both of them did the breakdowns for all the art. Mm-hmm. There's character model sheets that are a lot of fun. I really like these Mausers, and a bunch of other design work and stuff for the city. Like, it is a really cool package. I can't remember what the original one was, like $8.99 or something like that. This is $10.99. You're getting a lot of good, you're getting your money's worth, I think. If you're liking it, I recommend the director's cut.
And then also, you have the new Jim Henson thing.
Yeah, I occasionally like to champion this. These, you know, Arkea has all the Jim Henson stuff, and, you know, Labyrinth and, what's the other one? Dark Crystal tend to be the sort of notable ones. But they also took that old show of his, Jim Henson Storyteller, where they did myths and legends. And they do different theme each time. And this miniseries is about tricksters, like trickster folktales and legends. Mm-hmm. Now, my impression has been from previous ones that they were rooted in the style of different sort of, you know, fairy tales and legends around the world, but not directly adapted. Well, this one I think is. It's a story about the trickster god from Africa, Anansi, and it's a really good one. It is about how he brought stories to the world, and he has to go to, like, his father, who is, like, I think sort of like the king of the gods, the Zeus of the gods. And by the way, there's beautiful art on this. He is a full-on spider god, but, like, centaur style with, like, what looks like sort of like a fantasy African warrior, you know, from the waist up. Looks really neat. And then his that's the king of the gods there with these sort of multicolored robe. Anyway, he's like, you can't have, you know, this. He has, like, this giant, it's almost like a cauldron of stories, like the water and stuff in the stories. And Anansi wants to take it to the people. Trickster gods always seem to be, they're all about, like, getting the stuff from gods to man.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of equalizing the playing field.
Loki did nothing wrong.
Something I always like about Loki and Prometheus and all those guys and Coyote. And basically, he's got to, like, outwit all these, like, his father is like, you can do it if you perform these tasks. And so he's got to, like, go up against all these monstrous jungle creatures. It is a fun story that I think people who, like, say, like, Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology, this would be straight up the alley of it, because it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but also takes it seriously, too. Even though it uses the framing device of the guy talking, chatting with his dog that all the Jim Henson storyteller do. But it was the art's so good in it, and the story was so good that I will probably, this will be one of those rare single issues that I pick up.
You know who else talks to his dog?
Who is
Berkowitz?
Oh my goodness.
Just saying.
You are saying that Jim Henson is the son of Sam. Is that what I'm getting?
I'm saying I've never seen them in the same room together.
Interesting. Well, I can't refute that evidence. Ted Cruz is the Zodiac. In conclusion.
There's also a couple trades I like this week. It's Chip's the Darkseid week, so his Stillwater, his new town full of immortals, gets a volume one. And then his Daredevil, which is one of my favorite books and has been for a few years now, gets a swanky hardcover volume one.
Does that hardcover have the equivalent of two small volumes
in it?
It does. Nice.
It has like 12 issues, I think. 10 or 12. And then Cyberpunk, Cullen Bunn's Cyberpunk series, which the first issue sold out really quickly, and if you missed it, it was kind of hard to get. That gets clicked into a trade this week, which
that's
I'm
cool.
kind of excited to read. The other stuff for me Transformers Back to the Future number 3. This book has been super delayed, but every time it comes out, it's a delight, and this week was no different.
There is something, a Decepticon that appears in this, and I'm not going to say what his alternate form is, but it has to do with something that's in Back to the Future, and it was a hilariously great idea.
Yeah, what is it?
It's Doc Brown's hair. No, I cannot say, but it is something that
my hair is a Decepticon, future boy.
It is something when you see it, you should go, that's amazing.
yeah, for sure. And then Radiant Black, which is their new superhero book over an Image. I really like the second issue of this. It's got a little bit of that Invincible energy, the early days of Invincible. They're being smart about it. He faces off with his opposite number. And there's also sort of a moral decision he makes as a hero, where it's like, oh, good, they're doing the Spider-Man route. They're going he doesn't do the easy thing, he does the right thing.
Nice.
Which is a notable thing. I'm really liking Radiant Black. I think it's an interesting superhero. They pitched it as sort of Power Rangers-y, but I'm definitely getting more of an Invincible vibe from it.
Interesting.
And then Thor number 13, which continues the evil Donald Blake and brings Odin back into the mix.
Okay.
Continues Donnie Cates' stuff, and I'm really digging that.
Yeah, I forgot. That means that I'm going to have a lot of people calling this week looking for Thor, because every time there's a new Thor issue, it's like an event now.
Anything else on y'all's list?
I think that's it for me. Nick, did you have anything else to shout about?
No, I think you've covered everything.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about a TV show and possibly other stuff. We just have a couple of TV shows we've been watching that we want to talk about. Before we do that, Nick, real quick, is going to mention, you have seen Raya and the Last Dragon?
Yes, I broke down and got premiere access to it because it's new, it's available, I had to have it.
Disney owns you.
Everybody owns.
They already got your Mulan money, Nick.
Yep, and they get me every month for my Disney Plus. Every once in a while, they'll get $30.
Yep.
However, honestly, this was a fantastic movie. It's a great way to spend, I think it's an hour and 40 minutes, so it's a really good length for an animated film.
All right.
And it's just, it's worth it. I mean, it is legit. Good story, great animation.
What is it based on?
It's an original story.
It's an original story. But it is set
in kind of a weird, alternate world fantasy where...
Japan, China?
No, it's like Thailand, and it's like other cultures, right? They mix and match like three or four different cultures.
Well, yeah, basically the world is broken apart when these beings that basically turn people to stone kind of invade. Dragons are kind of destroyed or beaten, and basically culture collapses in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
And it's about a young woman who's the daughter of like one of the tribes,
mm-hmm.
and things happen to her and put her on a quest.
And her name is Rhea, and she meets the Last Dragon.
She is voiced by
Bruce Leroy.
I forget her name, but who played Rose Tico in the Star Wars: The Last Jedi?
Yes,
Kelly Marie Tran, and then Last Dragon is Awkwafina, who is amazing.
Awkwafina might be the Last Dragon.
Let me ask, if I don't always love the anachronistic Disney characters, am I going to... And I like Awkwafina, but am I going to like find her a little bit annoying?
I mean, she's Awkwafina. If you like Awkwafina, you're going to the character.
Dan, how do you feel about Mushu?
Not a huge fan.
Okay.
I mean, there's some comparisons you could make to the two characters, but I feel like if you like Awkwafina, the person, injects enough.
I also don't dislike Mushu. Like, you know, like, these characters are always endearing.
I think what you're going to find enjoyable is the world. Yeah. It is a very kind of
well-fleshed out. It's CG, right? Not traditional animation?
Everything is CG at this point, yeah.
But it's legit gorgeous. There's some rain scenes that I was just like... I mean, I'm watching it in 4K, so I guess that's something. Mm-hmm. But it's beautiful.
Dave, how do you feel about Donkey, another Eddie Murphy cartoon sidekick?
Is that from Shrek? Yeah. Never seen Shrek.
Really?
Yeah. I skipped Shrek.
Highly recommend it or anything, but I liked it at the time.
But the cast is amazing. It's not only those two, but the subcast is like Benedict Wong and Gemma Chan. Wow.
I know that you two guys, I don't know if you said this, Nick, I know you two guys liked the movie Soul.
Yep, quite a bit.
And I think you said you liked this better.
I did.
And you said that it made Soul seem like it was utter crap in comparison.
I did say that. Yeah,
you were like, you know what? Soul now is terrible. Soul is like, it's like one of those awful direct-to-video movies.
I'm also a sucker for adventure fantasy.
When they ask you, well, go ahead, finish your thought.
And it just kind of hit the sweet spot of that.
Yeah, I love something like Last Airbender. When they get that right, I'm like, man, that's the stuff. Nick, did you cry?
I did.
All right. It's not Disney.
I think multiple times.
It's not Disney if you don't.
It's true. Changing tones a little bit. I have been catching up on a bunch of CBS procedural stuff. I watched Clarice, which we talked about last week. I watched an episode of Coyote, which I cannot disrecommend in the strongest terms.
Yeah, I watched the first episode and I was like, okay, man. I kind of run with it. I like Michael Chiklis.
It's exactly what I feared it was going to be.
The second episode killed it for me.
A little bit xenophobic.
Yeah.
And he is like a Border Patrol agent and he's a jerk. And I'm like, yeah, I got no interest.
Can Michael Chiklis not play a jerk in his next role?
He only plays jerks or the commish.
He's such a good actor, and I feel like he can do more, but he gets stuck in this role.
I agree.
The Shield kind of killed it for him, I think.
What's that?
The Shield kind of just put him in the role.
Yeah, which is too bad, because The Shield was such a breakout for him, and then it became...
Didn't he play somebody cuddly a few years ago? I mean, a few years ago. He was on ABC Family.
Yeah.
Which was terrible.
Oh.
How is Walton Goggins, like... become can show his like with the Unicorn, which is one of CBS's best sitcoms, which still is.
I guess the only way I'll watch Coyote again is if it crosses over with the Unicorn.
I need to see a clip of that because I just cannot picture Walton Goggins in a sitcom role.
He's hilarious.
I believe it though.
Wasp. You've seen him do Goofy.
That's true.
And also, I will say that
even in G.I. Joe, he was goofy.
Yeah.
Branding Unicorn as a sitcom is kind of a little bit harsh. It is a sitcom. It's a 30-minute show. But there's a lot
sitcoms
of heart.
Sitcoms are different
in it.
Now, too.
It's a lot of heart. There's better writing in it than I think traditionally is in.
It's a good sitcom.
It's not Good Place good, but it's up there.
It might be Friends level good.
It's better than Friends. Although I love Friends, so I can't really say
that. But the show that I'm liking of all the CBS procedurals is The Equalizer, which is a reboot of a show I've never seen even like a 30 seconds of.
Me neither.
He was an older guy
who like went out and helped people who needed help.
I only knew of the Antoine Fuqua, Denzel Washington. Equalizer
movie. Which I've never seen. Are those good?
They're kind of revenge porn.
If you liked Man on Fire,
yeah. If you like Man on Fire, and
now, in the 80s version, was he a vigilante?
Yeah,
like would he kill people?
I don't know. Nobody killed anybody on TV in the 80s.
Let's just make it up.
Sure.
He killed only walruses.
He killed only walruses.
Did the A-Team kill people? I don't think they did.
Nah, they made explosions. No, they would throw a grenade and you would flip.
Yeah, Duke flipped over.
They used only flip grenades. Let me ask you now, because
he flip you for real.
I believe in the movies. I bet there's killing. Revenge porn.
Oh god, yeah.
And now, Randy, does Queen Latifah kill?
I'm trying to think if she does. Does she kill people?
She did.
Oh, that's right, she does.
The two guys.
There is a lot of shooting out tires, though.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It is kind of a, like, reined-in vigilante.
But they've outright made her... Like, her backstory is that she is a badass. Yeah. She is, like, one of the best spies.
So the premise of this is that she is ex-CIA. She quit because she's a single mom, and now she's, like, taking care of her daughter. Her daughter doesn't know what she did, but she thought she was, like, a museum curator or something like some other travel-y job. I don't remember what
mom knows what she does.
Her mom doesn't know what she does. So she basically is ex-CIA. Chris Noth plays her ex-like handler trainer, and he's great.
This is like the part he was born to play.
And then she has Adam Goldberg, who is like her hacker friend, and his wife, who I forget the actress's name, but she is like a sniper troublemaker type person.
Yeah.
And they are basically her backup team. So basically she stumbles into this thing with a girl who gets accused of killing someone when in fact she was the witness to these two hitmen, these Black Ops hitmen, killing somebody. And the cops can't help her. This detective who is like a good guy but basically can't help her. She winds up going to Queen Latifah somehow. She runs into her.
Yeah.
And she basically helps her out. And then she starts this like helping business where she's like helping people who can't go to the cops for whatever reason.
You know what? Like the bones of this show feel very Person of Interest.
Yeah, it does.
And Person of Interest was one of my favorite shows.
Yeah.
I love that. And this one is really entertaining.
It's really fun.
A lot of that falls on Queen Latifah.
She's great.
She really does a great job of like pushing the story forward, and she's just good in the role.
Yeah.
I like her daughter.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
I like everything about this show. I actually think it's a really good sort of week to week procedural. There's a bit of a storyline going
on. Why surprisingly, by the way? Just because I don't know how old she is.
I'm usually a teenager.
I was thinking the same thing with Superman and Lois.
Yeah.
Where I did expect that them to be annoying angsties, and instead they're good angsties.
Yeah.
It's well done.
I'm seeing more and more good angsties as opposed to previously where I was like, oh God, we're going to do this storyline.
People, writers might have kind of learned a lesson vaguely collectively.
But yeah. I will say, for me, Adam Goldberg's neurotic hacker, he is amazing.
Great. Yeah.
It sounds like fun. If I want to watch this, where do I watch it?
CBS All Access.
Paramount Plus.
Or Paramount Plus.
But that'll carry over for me.
And Dave, we know you have that because you have to watch Star Trek.
Yep.
So yeah, it's fun. And then, Dave, you were going to talk about the Blinders Most Peaky?
Yes. Peaky Blinders is a show that's on, I believe it's sixth and final season is being made now.
Yeah.
I've got a friend who's very into it, and we've occasionally been watching it, while we text online and stuff like that. Rewatch for her, first time for me. This is a show that I kind of think of as feeling like a Scorsese Gangs of New York kind of thing, but it's set in Birmingham, England, in the early 1920s and late teens when it starts. And I'm actually, as for the premise goes, I'm just going to read you what they say on Wikipedia. Peaky Blinders is an epic following a gangster family of Irish origin set in Birmingham, England in 1919, several months after the end of the First World War in November 1918. Story centers on the Peaky Blinders gang and their ambitious and highly cunning boss, Tommy Shelby, that's Cillian Murphy.
Okay.
The gang comes to the attention of Major Chester Campbell, Sam Neill, a detective chief inspector in the Royal Irish Constabulary, sent over by Winston Churchill from Belfast, where he'd been sent to clean up the city of the Irish Republican Army. Communists and all this. So that is sort of sets the stage for season one, which is the gang, which they like run numbers at the tracks and stuff like that. But they all dress sort of in these like immaculate suits and stuff like that.
Yep.
They've gotten some money, and what the core of the gang is that it is his family. So you have a little bit of that Godfather-y kind of vibe, or Sopranos, even Goodfellas, even though I know they weren't blood relatives in it. A sense of like a family ties, a very dysfunctional family, but kind of look out for each other in their way. They have something of a code.
Hmm.
And they they're starting to make some serious money as it begins. And in the first season, they like steal some stuff, which turns out to unexpectedly have all these guns that were going to go to like the IRA. And the Churchill's, like they say, sends Sam Neill over, and Sam Neill is this just bastard of a cop kind of guy. He's great. Sam Neill's great in it, actually. And he's...
you could just stop it. Sam Neill's great.
He's great. He's looking... He is like the adversary who can match them in a way, and he's trying to find those guns, and that's... Each season has sort of a driving core plot. They're only six-episode seasons, though.
Oh.
So it's over, and this is why I can go through three seasons, even though I'm not a marathon
person. Is this a BBC-produced Netflix, or is this straight up Netflix?
I believe it is.
You know what's interesting, Dave? You talked about this. I watched Boardwalk Empire.
Yep.
Which takes place in 1919 to 1924, something like that. Same period. But it's in Atlantic City. But his like wife is a is an Irish woman played by Kelly MacDonald, and in like the second or third season, I think, there is a guy played by Charlie Cox, aka Daredevil.
Yep.
Who comes over from he's an IRA volunteer who comes to work for Nucky. So there was clearly some like bootlegging Irish stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Peaky Blind Boardwalk Empire was heavily influenced by like history.
So this is based on history.
So
Peaky Blinders is a real gang.
I bet there's some crossover there.
That sounds like it. So they were a real gang, and by the way, the name comes from they wear these like sort of like dapper caps, you know, like a little like a beret kind of whatever you call those things.
Yep.
And they tuck this only comes up a few times, but they tuck razor blades into them, or they will actually swing the hat at you and like literally blind you with it. That is what they scare their opponents with. It actually only happens like once or twice. I don't think it ever literally happens. It's almost more of a threat, you know.
I'm not sure if the Peaky Blinders is a better name than the Dapper Caps.
They should be live again. There's some good casters in here.
So that's what I was going to say. It's like the casting is great, and every season usually has a few guest stars who are like really good people. So one of them is there's a lot of sort of ethnic rival gangs in it. And one of them is a Jewish gangster played by... God, who's the guy who played Venom and a million...
Tom Hardy.
He has such a blast playing this very scary gangster who's also a little unhinged like all of Tom Hardy's characters.
Does he do a voice?
He does.
Of course he does.
It's not quite like a... It's not the wildest of voices. He's mostly getting to do his native accent, but so he's great in it. Adrian Brody is in the season I'm watching right now, playing an Italian mobster that they've crossed.
Anya Taylor-Joy is in it.
Oh,
who's that?
She was Queen's Gambit. She played Magic in the New Mutants.
Oh, I don't know if I've seen her yet. I guess it depends on what series.
Yeah, I'm not sure
what season she shows up in. But you know, and Cillian Murphy is interesting as at the center of it is his guy, and he's this very kind of emotionally distant guy. He and a lot of his family, his brothers, got damaged in World War I, and he takes heroin for it. Some of them use cocaine. Oh, by the way, I meant to tell you that part of what gives the series its energy is it uses contemporary music.
Oh, right.
And it has a very set tone of this kind of grungy White Stripes rock. Like, there's a lot of Jack White in the first season, Nick Cave. I'm trying to think.
Did you say the intro music is Nick Cave?
It is Red Right Hand. And they actually have several different covers of it that are used throughout the course of the show, from slow versions to, like, really, grunged up, sludgy versions.
Mm-hmm.
But the show has, like, these guys are getting in brawls all the time. They're fun and funny to watch. It is, like, kind of like there is a vibe that will get you kind of pulled into the family of it, and, like, both kind of think, like, they're kind of scumbags, but I kind
of
like them.
Is it like the grunge of, like, a Guy Ritchie film?
I kind of think so. It is not that stylish, but it has some of that vibe to it. Those kind of characters. His brother, his older brother, Arthur, that is to say, Thomas Shelby, the lead, is this very smart planner. And this is a pretty violent show, by the way. This is a very violent show. But his older brother, Arthur, is, like, always getting in brawls. Ironically, in later seasons, when he marries this woman who's, like, kind of, like, brings a little Christian civility to him, and his brothers just hate her. They're just like, because it sort of slightly civilizes him. And this is a guy who would get into, like, boxing matches and, like, even killed a guy in a boxing match, like, at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly he's like this, like, I've got to go tend to the garden and stuff kind of thing. But, usually what you're seeing in any given season is the Shelby family's rise and fall against some new threat, somebody trying to expand into their territory, them trying to expand into somebody else's territory, dealing with revenge plots, dealing with both being hunted by, like, law enforcement and occasionally used by them, like, you know, blackmailed into stuff. Winston Churchill shows up several times in it. Now, I believe most of this stuff is fictional, but at least the baseline parts are kind of based in reality. Anyway, it is a super, super fun show. Randy, I think that you in particular might like it.
Dave, and realizing that it's very similar to Boardwalk Empire, which I wound up really liking, I was going to add to my TV catch-up list.
Mm-hmm.
It was already on my TV catch-up list, so...
Oh, well, there you go.
It definitely intrigues me. When I'm in the mood for a 20s gangster thing next, I will maybe give this a shot.
Yeah, you may have sold me on it too.
I would at least, the first episode is one of those that, like, I feel like it's a really good first episode. It'll give you the vibe for what the series is like.
All right. I think that's it for us this week. We'll be back with more next week. And until that time,
yo, Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com, and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.